recently wrote about Google's insatiable thirst for energy, going as far as calling them evil for doing so. Now, that's obviously kind of tongue-in-cheek, but let me quote some more telling numbers about these statements. So first, a recent study showed that Google's power consumption cost them about $40 million per year, and that was a relatively conservative estimate as well. Secondly, the EPA has projected that just in 2 years, all data centers combined will soon be spending over $7 billion a year on the energy, and will comprise 3% of total energy usage in the U.S. Now, if these numbers don't resonate with those of you in academia, try this one. The annual cost of energy for Google, Microsoft, and Amazon combined would pay for the stipend and tuition for every single first-year CS PhD student. So this is kind of disturbing. So more seriously, the big question we're trying to answer is, how can we reduce the amount of energy consumed by clusters by a factor of 10, while still being able to run the same kinds of applications we do today? And while energy efficiency is a laudable goal, it's particularly attractive when it saves you money. So we have to make sure that our efforts don't actually increase capital costs. So our answer to that question is what we call FON, or fast array of what we know. And the basic idea here is to try to improve the energy efficiency of data-intensive computing by using a large set of well-balanced low-power nodes. So for example, here is our prototype cluster using a number of embedded systems that each are normally used as, say, homebrew routers or wireless networks. But the idea is to try to replace these traditional servers that use multiple high-speed processors, lots of memory, and several fast disks with an architecture that tries to use more of those wimpier components at larger scale, and in doing so, saving energy. So in this talk, I'm going to hopefully convince you that you can use these low-power systems as these building blocks. So before I go into more detail, let me just first understand where FON fits within the scope of solutions to save energy in data centers. First off, we need to power, cool, and distribute a data center servers. And that power and cooling input, turns out you lose about 20% of our energy, our vertical energy, just to do that. Now, this is actually a good number, and state-of-the-art techniques are getting us here, and there's improvements to be made as well. But let's consider the servers. A set of, say, 5 servers operating at full utilization might consume anywhere from about 1,000 watts. But because servers don't operate at 100% utilization all the time, if they're only operating at 20%, it turns out that they use a significant fraction of the peak power consumed. Now, there's a lot of work being done to try to improve the energy proportionality of these devices. And that's a great line of research, and we're looking forward to seeing that. But the FON approach is completely different, which is to try to reduce the amount of energy these servers consume even at peak power, at peak utilization. And any improvements we see to energy proportionality should only help us. So now that you know a little bit about what we're trying to do with FON, let me try to explain why we think the FON approach is actually the right way to save energy. And I'll look at this solution by showing the FON well-known CPU I/O gap. This graph here shows the trends for CPU cycle times, DRAM access times, and disk seek times over the past 25 years. And note that the y-axis here is log scale. Now, this large gap between, say, the CPU cycle time and the disk seek time can represent wasted resources. And trying to rebalance these systems would go a long way to reducing both idle cycles and these wasted resources and energy. But there are many ways to actually rebalance a system. So let's consider some examples. First, we might consider using today's fastest processors and trying to improve the speed of the I/O by saying, use a lot of fastest disks and put them in the large storage array. And note here that basically the arrow pointing down shows making the disks faster. An alternative approach might be to try to find some middle ground between this, which is to say, we'll use slower CPUs and moderately faster storage, but try to find a balance between one direction or the other. And on the far extreme, we could consider just using today's disks and trying to slow down our CPUs to the appropriate point. Now, these are all balanced systems, but they're not equally energy efficient. Let me explain why. So, here's a graph showing the speed versus efficiency trade-off for a number of modern processors. On the x-axis, we have the number of instructions per second each processor can achieve. And again, note the log scale of the x-axis. And on the y-axis, we have the efficiency of these processors. And we measure that as their speed divided by their power rate. We've also added a 0.1 watt power overhead to these devices, too, because processors by themselves can't do anything in a cluster without communicating. And we added a 0.1 watt overhead just to say what happens if you attach an Ethernet card to it. What you'll notice is that the envelope of this graph looks something like this. So let's kind of, you know, go through the regions. On the very far right, we find that the fastest processors out there are really fast, but they aren't as efficient as some of the other systems on this graph. And that's because they try really hard in terms of spending transistors and power to try to hide the CPU I/O. So they use techniques like speculative execution, branch prediction, out-of-order execution, and large amounts of caching. And these are all techniques that don't improve the speed of basic operations. And for many of the I/O-bound workloads we see in data centers, these techniques aren't as useful. On the other hand, if you consider the left side of the graph, you have these typically efficient processors by themselves. But if you have a small fixed power overhead on those systems, it turns out that they're just dominated by the fixed cost. So what Flan's really trying to target is this region of the curve where you can basically have some amount of fixed power costs that are unavoidable, but those systems as a whole are energy efficient. So with this graph, let's try to reconsider those balancing options on the previous slide. Kind of look at this graph in this form where on the x-axis you have more efficient going to the right and faster going down. Now the approach of using the fastest processors, even if you're trying to balance the I/O perfectly, means that we'll operate in this region of the curve where we're operating inefficiently. And similarly, if you look at the other extreme, the fixed power costs tend to dominate again here as well. And so the right way to balance computation in I/O is to ensure that we operate in this highest region of the system efficiency curve. And that's really what Flan's trying to make the argument for. So with those high-level ideas in mind, let me be a bit more concrete and try to apply the Flan architecture to a specific workload. And the workload we focus on in this talk is going to be key value storage. And we'll choose this for several reasons. First, key value storage systems have become critical pieces of infrastructure for many web services, such as Memcached for Facebook or Amazon's Dynamo for their shopping cart application. Second, key value storage also is used with these customer-facing applications in many cases. And so they have service-level agreements that they have to adhere to, which makes it a particularly difficult target for a would-be cluster architecture. And finally, many key-value systems tend to lack locality of access to data, and so relying on caching alone sometimes can be an extremely power-hungry and costly solution. So to prove the feasibility of Flan architecture, we built Flan KV, which is our custom cluster key-value system. And the main goal of this architecture is to improve the energy efficiency of key-value lookups, as measured by queries per joule or queries per second per watt. Now, our prototype Flan cluster uses those Alex3C2 boards I showed a picture of earlier that have a 500 MHz processor, a small amount of DRAM, and a relatively slow compact flash card. So it's going to be hard to run today's modern solutions on this kind of architecture because the Flan architecture poses three unique challenges. So first of all, we expect to have 10 times as many nodes in a Flan cluster as compared to a traditional cluster. So things like node additions and failures are going to be much more common. And to our knowledge, today's solutions don't provide the efficient, fast failover at the scale we're looking at. Second, because each individual node is relatively crippled compared to today's modern fast systems, it requires careful attention to how we use the resources on each individual machine. And finally, we do use flash storage because it has great random read performance compared to disks. But it's become well known that flash performs really, really poorly for small random writes. And the random access patterns of key and value sizes of key value storage systems poses a challenge here. But we'll see how these unique challenges require us to carefully think about the design of the Flan KV system. So let's start out with a brief architecture overview. We have two types of nodes in Flan KV, front-end nodes and back-end nodes, and they're separated by a switch hierarchy. So the backend nodes in our system store the actual data in a local data store called Fontius, and I'll discuss this in more detail in just a second. The frontends, on the other hand, have three responsibilities. First of all, they manage the backends they are responsible for. They insulate clients from potentially having to know about thousands, ten thousands of leading node clusters. And because they are the frontends to the systems, they have to route the requests to the appropriate nodes. And in this project, we actually use system hashing to provide incremental scalability. Now, these responsibilities are actually mostly straightforward, and most of the interesting design questions for FontKV happen to be related to the way that backends operate. So this talk will be focusing mostly on the backends. But let's first consider at the bottom of the slide the constraints imposed for Quant for this key value storage application. And we'll break out the constraints into two portions. One for the FontDS app part of the code, and one for the FontKV portion of the system. And we'll see how the design tries to solve these constraints. So first, because we're trying to be a high-performance key-value store, we have to first map keys to values on the back end. Now, FontDS stores the key-value pairs on flash, which is on the data region portion of the store. But it uses a hash table only stored in memory to find the value based on a particular key. So for example, we have this 160-bit key. We want to try to figure out where the value resides. So we'll index in the hash table. And each entry there has three components: a key fragment, a valid bit, which basically shows whether the entry is valid for delete operations, and the offset into the data log portion where the data is actually stored. So that data log entry contains three components: the full key, the length of the data, and the data log itself. Now, most of the time, when you have a request for a key, you'll do one lookup in RAM and one lookup on flash. But because of the limited amount of DRAM on our systems, we couldn't actually store the entire 160-bit key in each entry in the hash table. We wouldn't be able to address that many objects. So we could only store a key fragment. But by doing this, we were able to get each entry to about 12 bytes per entry, which allowed us to address all storage capacity of our prototype nodes. But because we don't actually store the entire key in memory, there's a possibility that when we do look up an entry in the hash table, there's a key fragment collision. And so we only discover the collision by going to the data region and finding out that the key doesn't match. In that case, we basically have to probabilistically make multiple requests for key value lookups. But this probabilistic trade-off was actually required to deal with the constraints of our release system. It's one of the lessons we learned. So we're able to basically take off that challenge of trying to deal with limited resources at the FontDS layer. So what about random writes, small random writes? To avoid this in FontDS, our key design choice was to make the data region log structured. So while things like get operations can randomly read from flash without a huge performance penalty, put operations or delete operations must be implemented as appends. And so for example, delete operations will append a delete entry to the log, and we defer the actual cleanup of the log to a later garbage collection. And I'll talk about that in a second. Now, this basically solves from the perspective of avoiding random writes, but at the FontDS layer. But it turns out this log structure design also was made to solve the constraints at the FontKV RIM structure level. And let me explain how. So let's first look at what happens when you have a node addition in FontKV. So this is very similar to a node failure, but this is a bit easier to understand. So because we use consistent hashing, the node B here owns the key range from H to B and stores the associated data in the FontDS data store. Now let's say a node A joins the system between H and B. A now owns the region that B used to own of H to A, but it needs to get the appropriate data range from B. Now because, this requires entire transfers of key ranges, which for a production system means we have to do these operations in the background while continuing to serve data. But thankfully, because of the log structure, it turns out that these node addition and failover operations are extremely efficient. That's because nodes simply have to sequentially stream data from one node to another. So let's take one example of where B has to transfer the green data blocks in its data store, which now are owned by A. It can do this by iterating over its data store and copying sequentially over the network all the data blocks required for A. And A can write this as a sequential write as well. Now this basically solves a simple operation of transferring data ranges sequentially. But because of the service level agreements, we have to make sure that B can continue serving queries to the data store. So for example, we have to make sure that during concurrent insertions, we don't lock the data structure because it has to continue operating. So as more data starts flowing into the data store, we have to propagate this data all the way to A. But because it's a locked structure, we can do this effectively. And we only lock for a brief moment at the very end of this operation. And this typically takes something like 30 milliseconds, which is relatively low. And finally, you have things like garbage collection, right? For removing out-of-range entries, the green data blocks here, or deleted entries. Now, this, of course, is just a sequential pass over the data and sequential write to its local data store. And then that basically performs a compaction operation. So in other words, all of these background operations are simple stream operations, just sequential reads and sequential writes. So they both avoid random writes on flash, and they make the failover relatively efficient and low overhead. So we're able to take those portions off as well. So in sum, we had to use the appropriate set of techniques to overcome the constraints of the FON architecture, but we demonstrated that it was possible to do so. We used a log structure data store to avoid small random write problems on flash, and it also made failover more efficient. And at the same time, we're able to do this while continuing to serve queries to meet the SLA goals, the service level agreement goals. We also have to pay close attention to how we use the resources, and we have to make the appropriate trade-off between performance and resource utilization to get this to work. Now, although I did not discuss this in detail, our system also provides replication and strong consistency models by using a variant of chain replication. And I encourage you to take a look at the paper for more of these details. So next, I'll touch on a small subset of our evaluation of FONBB. So we're going to look at the following. First, we're going to see the performance of key value lookups for several different systems and try to quantify the energy efficiency benefits. Second, we're going to go over the impact of these background operations on kind of query throughput when things window scale over. And finally, we'll look at cost a bit more closely by analyzing total cost of ownership for serving random read workloads by using a variety of different connections. So to start out with, we ran a bunch of FONDS random read benchmarks on several different machines and tried to measure the speed of 256 byte key value lookups. This table here shows the queries per second each system achieved, the power drop of each of these systems as measured at the wall socket, and the resulting energy efficiency value. Now, first, you'll notice that the ALEX3C2 node consumed only about 4 watts, but it was able to perform about 1,300 queries per second, and the resulting efficiency was something like 350 queries per joule. Now, if you compare that to, say, the hard drive-based systems, we'll see that their performance is limited greatly by the problems of seek times on traditional disks. So their efficiency is quite low. But to be more fair, we tried to put a modern SATA-based SSD on a traditional system. And we found that while the FONDS program we wrote was able to saturate the capabilities of the device, it turns out that the energy efficiency was completely dominated by the much higher power draw of this desktop system. So the conclusion here is that these FONDS-based systems, at least from a lookup perspective, can become over 6 times more efficient than traditional systems. So next, let's consider the impact of background operations on performance. Historically, the main drawback of log structured file systems on disks has been that the cleaning overheads cause performance to plummet for things like idle contention and disk seats. But now that we're using flash, we no longer have to worry about these kind of disk seats. So the graph on the left shows that in this particular experiment, we issued queries at about 1600 queries per second, which is the peak capacity of that single node. And then in the background, we spawn a thread to do either a compaction operation a split operation or a merge operation, which are required for maintenance. And in this experiment, we find that the query throughput drops pretty significantly by about 50%. But because we are saturating the disk with random reads, we expect some amount of query throughput to be dropped. But this doesn't have to do with things like disk seeks and I/O retention. To illustrate this point, consider the following experiment where we only query the node at 30% of its peak capacity. And in that particular case, the background operations pretty much had no impact on the external query throughput of the system. Now, we're trying to provide tunable knobs to trade off the speed of failover operations for lower impact at peak load. And the main takeaway is that these background operations can be pretty moderate when you're operating at 100%, but that these cleaning overheads are perfectly acceptable when you're operating at a more stable operating point. So hopefully I've convinced you so far that our implementation of FongKV for these low power systems actually improves energy efficiency for cluster key value storage. But energy efficiency alone isn't the only metric worth considering. That's because ultimately data center operators really care about trying to save on cost. So let's understand cost a bit more by trying to look at the total cost of ownership of serving random read workloads, where we define the total cost of ownership as the capital cost of purchasing the nodes and the 3-year power cost at 10 cents per kilowatt hour. So we want to ask the question, which architecture should I use for serving this random read workload? And we analyzed two different sets of architectures. The first one were traditional systems with a base power usage of about 200 watts. And we paired them with either a disk-based system consuming, taking 5 2-terabyte disks, either that or a PCIe-based SSD flash device, or just saying, we want, we don't care about volatility or issues like that, we'll just use a lot of RAM, really, really fast RAM. And the cost here roughly are about $2,000 to $8,000 per node, depending on what kind of storage technology you use. And we've accounted for factors like bulk discounts as well. On the other hand, we also compared to FON-like systems that consume roughly 10 to 20 watts each, paired with either a single mechanical disk, a single SATA-based flash SSD drive, or a really small amount of DRAM per node relative to the traditional machine. And the cost here, based on publicly available information, shows it's about $250 to $500 per node. So, to understand which architecture is the right one, we can kind of first characterize a workload by two parameters, the size of the data set being served and the desired query rate to that random access data set. So what we've plotted here is which type of system had the lowest total cost of ownership for a given query rate and data set size. It turns out that the upper left portion of the graph is where storage capacity is the dominant factor. And the FON plus disk combo actually provides the lowest, the highest gigabytes per dollar of all the systems. If you look at the other extreme, the lower portion of the graph shows here that what you really care about is query rate. And in this particular case, the FON architecture with the TRAM can actually be the cheapest. And in between, you actually find that there's a large range where a FON plus flash architecture provides the right balance between storage capacity, query rate, and power cost. But I should mention that this graph doesn't capture all elements of cost. There are certain things like the cost of management, the cost of networking, cooling, and even land that's not factored into here. But to a first order approximation, it shows that this approach can actually be cost competitive with other architectures. And perhaps this is why we're now seeing a lot of low-power, low-cost server design proposals, both in industry and academia. And we think they're all pushing in the right direction. So in this talk, I've talked about the FON architecture being the right way to save energy in clusters. But that does require effort on the part of system developers to use successfully. And I showed you how the constraints of FON can be solved for one particular workload of FONKV with the techniques listed here. Now, the key value workload we've shown here is just targeting, scratching the surface of what we think the FON architecture is capable of. And we think the future is really bright for very interesting future research in this area. And at the very bottom, I listed a quote from people in the HPC community who've been building large clusters for a long time. And it shows that when we kind of think of this larger scale, we really have to figure out how to deal with an entire order of magnitude change in the number of systems. So with that, thanks for listening. We'll be happy to take questions. So the network is definitely an important component, and as you scale your data centers up and up and up, you want to try to provide things like full bisection bandwidth and all-to-all communication to provide the most general solution. If you use a traditional factory topologies that have, say, really, really high power core routers at the top level, it ends up being that that might not be that energy efficient. But in certain situations, there are proposals for using many low-power commodity switches at scale, for example, the SIGCOM 2008. And it turns out the analysis we've done shows that you can get down to a fixed power overhead for each node, which means that as long as you can get down to, say, 1 watt per port, that's reasonably acceptable. But it's definitely an interesting area of future work we'll be looking into that.
Facebook?
Yep. Yes.
So, I mean, looking at the network problem, the whole convolution, how does that connect that? That data change has to change if you scale up a little bit for the integration cost or the magnitude of the machine.
So, what we've shown here is that the number we use to generate this graph, assume things like the memory cache type architecture for traditional machines can get a million queries per second, which is reasonably high performance. It takes a lot of effort to get to that level of performance. So we tried to do our best to provide that, but what I wanted to try to get across here was a lot of it is the combination of the power cost and the cost of purchasing these nodes. If you have to scale to 200 nodes, we're using multiple nodes in this architecture. We're saying how many nodes does it take to serve a data set that has 1 terabyte and serve a billion requests per second. So we are factoring the number of Ruby nodes we're trying to serve. Yes, okay. So there's definitely issues of cost of management and cost of deployment. That's definitely an interesting question, but it has more to do with, I think, packaging and some possibly ephemeral aspects of the market, which I don't have an answer to.
I wonder how the node happens if the membership is in a transform state? What happens to the replication?
So, if you talk about things like partition tolerance, or are you talking about what is more
about, like, one of the things, one node is down, but the other thing is that it's back on the ground.
Right, so there's two aspects to this. Failure detection, being able to say that the node is down. We have optional replication. Basically, when the friend can detect that the server has gone down, or the backend has gone down, we can reroute those requests to other nodes on the ring to provide constant access to the data. And in the background, we'll make sure that we send the data from those nodes to